All right, let's get going. Here we go. So the plan today, what's the plan today? The plan today, welcome. The plan today is to kind of go through the last PowerPoints a bit, and then we can stop, ask, you know, answer questions that people have and everything. We can kind of go through some of the main points that we want to make sure that you cover. And if you haven't picked up the last test, it's up here, so we want to make sure that you get that. So let's go through a little bit where we are, and we're just going to wrap up. It just takes a little bit going back over the end of the PowerPoints that are up there. And we probably remember this stuff. Some of it's kind of just gee-whizzy, but it helps to pull it all back together again, right? So the end of the chapter, and if you bought your book, then you can say you got your money's worth because we covered every chapter in that book. Okay, so that's part of it. So at the end of this kind of book, just re-summarizing things up, and you think of it, pulling your other courses together, you know, cell, genetics, ecology, all that together for physiology of the animal, right? And how the physiology relates to the ecology of that animal or their niche that they're in. So we think of even, you know, how to measure activity. And if you wanted to measure metabolism of an animal and what their diet was, how do we do that again? If you could have unlimited resources of what you wanted to do, how might you measure if they're having a higher protein diet or a higher fat diet or just a carb diet? What was the way to measure that? Do we remember? When you break, go back to chapter 1 or 3, break down carbohydrates, C6, H12, O6, plus 6 oxygens goes to what? Water, metabolic water, and CO2, right? And so if you measured CO2 and oxygen consumption, what do we call that? Respiratory quotient, right? So you could actually measure respiratory quotient. See if it's a 1, you know, if it's pure carbohydrates, probably wouldn't be, but it gives you some idea, some measurements. People do that while animals train, for example. You can think of their, you could measure metabolic index, you could do that in different ways, you could measure heat production, all kinds of processes. So you just think, wow, all the things you learn, you know, you could actually approach questions in different ways to try to address it. It's kind of interesting when you think about mice on a running wheel, and some of you might work in labs with mice projects, or you see this all the time, you know, like to look at a mouse activity gram, for example. It's really funny because they put these little running wheels out in the field. An ecologist did this and showed that mice, if you actually put it like a activity monitor for animals out in the field, they move around looking for food at night and stuff, but when you put a running wheel out in the field, for some reason they get on it, and they just keep running. It's like an addictive behavior. Maybe like like my son when he plays computer games. But anyways, it's like an addiction. And but they actually had more activity when they had this wheel for some reason. And it's something they normally don't have in their natural environment. So some of those activity grams might actually give you a false impression of what the animal would normally do out in the real world. But it's a way to measure things under controlled conditions. And so it's really quite interesting, and you can think of different ways that people measure activity. There's lots of aspects now with Drosophila, even fruit flies, looking at activity grams with different diets or developmental issues or genetic mutations. So you see this kind of general behavior to relate to the physiology of the animal, or neurological problems, or muscle problems. But you see that you have to pull it all together and think of the whole animal, too. But if you want to relate that animal in the ecological arena, you can think about that as well. And if you think about how animals predict their environment or evolve for that environment, really neat experiments like circadian patterns. Has anybody taken a circadian pattern course? Sleep and circadian? Yeah, it was pretty good, right? I mean, yeah, not bad. Kind of okay. Okay, yeah, I wasn't really sure. Okay. But it's really quite interesting because you learn the cellular mechanisms of sleep and circadian patterns. I hope they kind of covered that, as well as the neurological pathways and different parts in the brain and defects that people have. Some people, you might have seen that on, a nature show. It was on CNN about 2 years ago, actually, where this person couldn't sleep, and they even gave him medications to try to make him sleep, and he couldn't sleep. And they realized that something was wrong with his nervous system in that part of the brain. And he actually died from the stress of not being able to sleep. So it's really quite amazing what you think about. You know, and that sleep is very important with your immune system, too. Actually, your immune system works really well when you're sleeping to help fight infection. But then you think about circadian patterns and how is all this controlled? So you can look at some animal on an intertidal zone, for example, and they can predict the, you know, physiologically that water's going to come in and now they're getting ready for a meal. And then you can actually put them in a lab and see if they keep that circadian pattern. And they do. So it's really quite interesting. You can take a little Drosophila egg, a fruit fly egg, that has a little, you know, larvae developing inside, and give the light pulses on and off for 12 hours on, 12 hours off. And then give them total darkness throughout first, second, third instar. And then they are pupa, total darkness. And when they come out as an adult, they have the pattern, the circadian pattern that you induced as an embryo. How do they remember that? How did the nervous system get entrained as it was developing as an embryo, and then in complete darkness throughout first, second, third instar and pupa, but somehow you can entrain them as a embryo? Isn't that wild? I mean, it's just wild, things like that. So really neat, and people are trying to figure out, you know, how does the circadian pattern work? How can you induce that? And then the problems, like what you said before about shift workers and health problems that they have if they're on a, you know, night shift working. So cortisol levels, go back to your endocrine part too. You have cortisol levels that probably rise in the morning before you get out of bed because the stress of getting out of bed, right, getting that foot out of the bed, and you need that glucose going up. But your cortisol rises before you get out of bed to get ready for that stress. And if you're into exercising, when might be the best time to really exercise? When you're working with your endocrine system in your glucose natural production. So some people really work around the natural processes of your body. You'll have another cortisol surge probably in the late afternoon if you're on a normal sleep cycle, but most college students probably aren't on a normal sleep cycle. It's all messed up. But you'll probably have another cortisol surge in the late afternoon and to get the glucose back up because that's the time you're kind of, you know, getting sluggish again. So it's pretty neat pulling all that together, and then you think of animal behavior as well with that. So just the kind of the idea. And what drives animal behavior? Well, evolutionary pressures, right, and selective pressures, and you can think of predation, right? So you think of that little mouse that's kind of a nocturnal animal. If anybody's raised them in your apartment or when you were growing up, you know that little wheel's running all night long, so you might actually stop that little wheel so you can get to sleep. And you think about, why do they do that? You know, why do they have these different behaviors and sleep maybe during the daytime to avoid predation, right? So it's really quite neat when you think about animal behavior, the physiology that goes with it, why did it come that way? And you think of like some salmon that will eat during the night, stay up at the surface of the ocean, but then dive during the day to avoid maybe some other predators that they might have. So you think of the whole process, it's really quite amazing. So let's think about some other aspects in acclimation or adaptation, right? That we've covered those terms a long time ago. But if you take an insect, like right now it's springtime, right? So it's pretty neat. The insects are coming out, horrible things, mosquitoes, right? But if you took a beetle in the summer and you put it in the freezer, maybe at almost freezing, let's say, you know, right at about 35 degrees, right? So it's almost freezing, but not. And then you took it out, it's probably going to die. But if you slowly cooled it down, and then got to that temperature even lower and then took it out, it survives, right? So it's really quite interesting when you think about why did these two different conditions allow that animal to survive? And it's kind of like us in a sense, you know, as winter comes along, the first cold spell, we're like, oh, it's so cold. But as we're, you know, into the winter and it's that same temperature, we don't really, okay, you know, we kind of got used to it, right? But on the sense of these invertebrates, like the beetles, and even in plants, that slow, gradual change is setting them up. And some of you had cell biology, right? Cell biology. Do you remember, maybe they covered this, in the conditions of, you can even work on cells in a culture dish and do this. If you want, remember the membrane fluidity, right? How it can change with temperature. And you can look at an enzyme that's produced called flipase. Did they ever cover flipase, right? And flipase is the enzyme that can help to new lipids that are made, and like a vesicle, to come up to the membrane, and it can actually flip the proteins into the membrane, or flip the lipids upside down, right, into the membrane. So now you have different types of lipids in the membrane, the bilipid membrane. So you can look at the enzyme production of flipase, mRNA expression level, and you can actually see that that's going up as you cold condition the animal. And then you can look at the membrane properties, and you can actually see, oh, the lipids are changing, the proteins are changing, and it's actually conditioning itself for that cold environment. But if you do it real fast, it doesn't have time to actually turn on that machinery to condition itself for that environment. And you can reverse that and do the same thing with warming it up. And you can do that with individual cells in culture, and you can see heat shock proteins being produced. They call them heat shock proteins because in heat, they go up in regulation, and people wonder, what do? But they actually are like accessory proteins, and they, around ion channels that we covered, like sodium channels, calcium channels, proteins, and the receptors on, say, your neuromuscular junction, the nicotinic receptors, that's not the only proteins there. There are many proteins around those other proteins that are accessory proteins that help hold them in the membrane or anchor them or actually help in their function. So if those accessory proteins aren't there, those channels might not work right or properly, or they might not be anchored in that part of the membrane. So heat shock proteins are like these proteins that help keep the structure of that protein functional. So you see heat shock proteins going up in warmer, like if you had cells and you were raising the temperature, and they actually help to hold the channel in the right conformation so it can work. So these associative proteins are very important. If you knock some of these heat shock proteins out, like they did in Drosophila earlier, and then raise the temperature up, they find out that the Drosophila die. But if they have the expression, then they can actually function and survive. So it's really quite neat. These were called heat shock proteins because they first discovered them with heat and raising temperature up, but they work also, the same kind of heat shock proteins, in cold. So some you might hear, it might be confusing, heat shock proteins going up in expression in cold. It's just because they identified them initially with temperature raising. So the idea of a beetle taking it out in the middle of the summer and cooling it down right away, almost to freezing, and it dies, it hasn't been able to condition itself to that cold environment, and it might freeze and die. So what are some of the aspects that animals in the cold can condition themselves to survive? And there's some really interesting aspects that you can think of. And we've talked about, like, the frog singing, remember? The male and the female frog being receptive at different temperatures, and you think the nervous system's even conditioning itself to respond. Like if the male frog's giving a cricket, you know, sound, the female only responds if she's at the same temperature, but if the male's at a different temperature and the sound's different, then the female doesn't respond. That's just, you know, phenomenal. Right? So if you think about the whole animal, right, you might look at metabolism, you might look at activity, you might look at respiratory quotient. You might look at all different types of physiological parameters. And you want to index it, right? So if we can't understand biology and put it into mathematical terms, we can't index it, then we don't really understand the process, right? So if you can put it in mathematical terms and you can index it, like how do they respond to the temperature change? So one of the indexes for temperature is a Q10. So a Q10 is whatever you're measuring. It could be metabolic rate. It could be enzymatic function. Every 10 degrees, you see how it changes. And you get a value for Q10. And so what's interesting is you can measure the whole animal's Q10, like activity or respiratory quotient. Then you can go down to the individual tissue. Or you might even go down, if you're in a biochemistry lab, down to a single enzyme, right? Like an ATPase, and find out what's the Q10 of that enzyme. Does that Q10 relate to the Q10 of the whole animal? Or you put multiple enzymes together, and then you find out, oh, this is how the cells function, and then the whole tissue, and then the whole animal. So from the whole animal down to the cell level, down to a single protein, you know, to an enzyme, for example. So Q10s are used for indexing. You don't have to memorize which Q10 values, but generally, round two, for a lot of biological processes, you'll see a Q10 of around 2. But it depends on that animal and its conditions as well, too. And if you have an animal that's conditioned at a particular temperature and you change it to another 10-degree change, that Q10 might be a little bit different than if it's conditioned at another temperature and you raised it or lowered it. So you can see how the animal conditions itself. So the take-home here is Q10 is an index that people can use to investigate how the whole animal functions, tissue functions, down to a cellular level, and even how enzymes function. And then we just talked about conditioning. So if you have an animal that's conditioned, for example, you'll see differences in the membrane. You change that temperature to a lower temperature, for example, or a higher temperature, it probably could survive better if it's been able to condition itself for that change, right? They've done some really neat studies with butchers that work like in the butcher shop at Kroger or something that are always handling cold food, like cold meat and things like that, or people that work with fish, for example, and they're handling ice a lot. They've actually done some neat old studies back 20 years. It was pretty interesting about thermal sensitivity on their hands, and they don't have the same kind of sensitivity that somebody that doesn't handle cold all the time, and there's just a difference. It's really quite interesting. So something's a little bit different about them. The sensory neurons aren't so sensitive to, say, the thermal sensation anymore. So things have changed in them as well within their lifespan, not an evolutionary lifespan. Okay, and these are just heat shock proteins to make you think about. You could actually see different animals that could survive different temperatures, for example, a change in temperature, and you think about how does that species survive and another species doesn't. You might look at some of these processes like heat shock protein expression, how fast they can turn it on. So it gives you the idea of conditions. I don't know if anybody has ever gone in the summers around Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, and you see in the summertime around August, is that you'll see, this weekend is the prawn harvest. Anybody ever see that? Anybody raise prawns or anything like that? No, prawns, those big shrimp that are really big, right? So there was a part in Kentucky where the government actually funded tobacco farmers to go and give them some money to start this, because you raise tobacco, you harvest it, and then you got all the money, and then you spend it all, and then you don't have any money for the rest of the year. So this was the way to actually try to give tobacco farmers some other industry for them, and they could actually apply to a grant to this state, and they would come in and actually help them dig a big trench in their farm area, and then line it, and then fill it up with water, relatively cheap to do, and just aerate it, right? And then they would actually supply them with little prawns. These prawns come from Malaysia, and they're used to high temperature, right? They're used to higher temperature. So they would throw these little prawns in, little juvenile prawns. In Kentucky State, up the road here at Frankfort, they actually have an aqua facility. If you ever get a chance, it's a fantastic place. They hire a lot of UK students, actually, to work there in summers, too, and throughout the year, if you want to get out and you like working with animals, for example. Aquaculture up there. And they have a very good training facility. Really good. But they do different things like raise tilapia, raise shrimp, raise prawns, find out the best ways, the best nutrients, how can you get the growth growing the best, and then looking at heavy metals and all kinds of things. Really a neat process if you ever get up to Kentucky State. And so they put these little prawns in at the beginning of the summer, just tiny little things, juveniles, but by the end of the summer, you've got a prawn. I mean, this isn't a fish story. It's really about that big. And the tail is really quite long, so it's a lot of meat, very quick. And so they harvest them in Malaysia all the time for food. And so this is what you see about prawn harvest. They drain the whole pond, and they get a whole bunch of prawns. And then you go and you just buy your prawns by the pound, and then you can go home and cook them. And they sell them in the local stores, like Good Foods, around that time of the year, too. You'll see them, big prawns. And so, but why is it they have to restock every year? It's because at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, they basically die out. If it's too cold, they just can't handle it. And why do they die? And you can take a crayfish, like the ones you worked with, and you can cool them down to where there's ice around them, and they're still going. You can actually record their heart rates and touch on them, and you can see the heart rate change. But a prawn would be dead by that time. So why is it that they die out so easily? They just maybe don't make the proteins to condition it. And even if you slowly bring them down, you can make them survive a bit longer, but they'll die in time, in another day or two. So it's just something really interesting to think about, the physiological properties, and not all animals can handle these environmental temperatures. We know how we heat up and condition ourselves, so you think about all the things that we do for thermal regulation. Breathing's one. But when you get, you know, kind of hot on a hot day when summer's coming up, I think we did this out in the outreach center when we were there. If you just, you know, instead of blowing against your face, right, which is kind of fun, just blow against your palm of your hand. Just for a second. You just try that. And see how, that's really cool, right? It's amazing because you really sweat a lot on your palms. When you get nervous, you sweat on your palms and your soles of your feet, right? You feel like you're swimming in your feet. But some people just cool themselves like fanning their hand, their palm of their hand. You can actually cool off that. But it's amazing the thinking about cooling and thermal regulation. And sweat is really important for that process too. But how we absorb heat or how we can heat our bodies or a heterotherm can heat their bodies from the environment or sitting in the sun, for example. Okay. So some really interesting aspects to think about with cold too. If you put your hand into cold water, what happens to your capillary beds in your skin? Vasoconstrict. Why does that happen? Because they don't want the cold blood to come back into your core body temperature and to cool you down. So this is why some people have that so severe, it's called Raynaud's syndrome, where they'll actually get very painful fingers and hands in the cold environment, like on a cold day. So then people might wear gloves to try to keep warm because they're so sensitive to the cold, they vasoconstrict. So it's really quite interesting to keep your core body temperature warm, where other animals might not have that, or heterothermic, for example. But really interesting about even when now you want to sweat, right? Like your palm of your hand or your forehead, and you're sweating. So what happens there? Vasodilation, right? And then you start to sweat. So those capillary beds, those arterioles, changing the direction of blood flow to then regulate body temperature. And pretty neat when you think about how the nervous system, the set point in your brain, controls how you're going to sweat or cool off, or that you're going to seek to get out of that, you know, a behavioral change to actually cool down. And people have looked at some really neat studies. You might think of those, you know, like a poodles, which is a really good dog for smell, right? We talked about that. Little toy poodles are great for olfaction. But they've actually done some neat experiments. People, you know, shave their poodles in the summertime because they're too hot and they think they're really hot, right? And so they've actually done these studies with thermal probe right on the skin. And when they shave the hair off the animal, the skin gets hotter. Then having the hair, that fluffy hair around the animal, and the sun's on it, then actually the skin temperature is lower. And you think, why is that? Kind of interesting, right? Well, that dead space, air that's a dead space, just like in your homes, the insulation, dead air space is the best insulator because it doesn't conduct heat well, right? So a dead air space is a really good insulator. So having that curly hair on the poodle is actually, they found out to be really good insulation to keep the skin from getting hot. So it's kind of neat. So maybe it's not a great idea to shave the dog, unless they're running and they're trying to evaporative cool, right? But if they're just sitting in the sun and those kind of experiments, that they actually, it kept the animal cooler by having that hair there. So kind of neat to think about. All right. Then kind of, just to refresh your memory, it goes all the way back to chapter one, homeotherms. And heterotherms are pachylotherms and homeotherms, or you can think of the older terms, cold-blooded, warm-blooded, you know, the same kind of idea. Don't get confused on those terminologies. But changing with the temperature, right, as with the animal, the environment, or regulating that temperature. And all different animals do it all different ways, so it's not just a set process, but we know ones that are really good conformers, like that, like this lizard in this example, versus other ones, but with the body temperature. But remember, then there's behavioral changes that go along with it. If you don't allow the animal to stay in that environment, or you gave them some freedom, they might go seek out shade, for example. Right? All right. So let's think about some ideas about how cells or how animals can survive the cold. And there's some really neat mechanisms. So think about, why do we put ice on the roads in the winter? What's the main point behind that? Salt. Sorry. Salt on the icy roads in the winter. What's the main idea behind that, chemist, that you've had your freshman chemistry for purged at all? It lowers the freezing point. How does it lower the freezing point mechanistically? How does salt lower the freezing point? Like these things that we just assume all the time, but, you know, let's get down to the mechanisms. Anybody remember? Ice crystals.
Like the ion protectors.
breaking up the crystal structure, actually, with the sodium chloride. You know, so you're breaking up that crystal structure so it can't freeze, so you lower the freezing point. So pretty neat to think about. So the same kind of idea that animals do. Actually, to decrease their freezing point, they can raise their osmolarity. They can raise their salt concentration. How do they do that? Get rid of the water. Raise their salt concentration. Insects, primarily, if you slowly condition them, you will see an increase in proline in their hemolymph, in their blood. They will increase amino acid concentrations. They will increase the salt concentrations, and that decreases their freezing point. So that's kind of neat. But if you also pull water out of the cell into the interstitium, right, in the extracellular, what happens to the osmolarity inside the cell? It's going to go up, and the freezing point goes down. So you don't want the cell to freeze, right? Because if you get ice crystals in the cell, you break up the organelles, like mitochondria and the nucleus, and then the cell's going to be damaged, right? So that's kind of interesting. Changing osmolarity is one approach. The other approach is to actually make antifreeze proteins. So the animals, if you slowly condition them, they can actually make antifreeze proteins. That's pretty cool. Or they might actually make glycerol and raise their glycerol concentration, which is like another antifreeze. It's the stuff you put in your car radiator in the winter, actually. And remember, don't ever just put that antifreeze in your car and leave it on the concrete or something like that, because for some reason, cats and dogs like to eat it, and it kills them. It causes a nephrotoxicity. So never get the animals around, you know, that stuff if you're putting it in your car in the wintertime. So that's interesting. So antifreeze proteins, glycerol concentration goes up, are changing the osmotic concentration in different ways. Maybe amino acids raising are getting rid of the water and increasing the salt concentrations changes the freezing point of the animal. All right, and like we just mentioned, the freezing point, like for the beetle, if you look at it throughout, if it's slowly changing the temperature, you can see the animal has conditioned itself, and you can bring it back up in the summer if these animals are experiencing that climate change, and they can actually survive because they're doing these changes. Pretty neat what animals go through to regulate their and survive, right? And you've done this experiment, which is kind of fun, right? The diving reflex, you put that cold water in your face, unless you convinced your partner in the lab to do it, and you didn't have to do it, right? But pretty neat, because it slows down your heart. But that happens in diving birds, diving mammals, and we have it too, isn't it? That's really cool. Right? And we talked about babies that are maybe born traumatically in a traumatic delivery, for example, didn't we remember that? And they used to give them an injection, try to slow the heart down or do different things, and then they found out all they needed to do was really take an ice rag, a cold ice rag, and put it on the baby's face, and the heart slows down. Because if something's traumatic for a delivery, for example, the baby might have what's called supraventricular tachycardia. Supraventricular, above the ventricles, atria, tachycardia, high atrial rate. So if the atria are beating really fast, what's happening? It's not filling the ventricles well, right? So a cold rag in the face slows the heart down, resets it, and that's all you had to do. No injections, no drugs. Just give a cold rag to the face. If somebody's really kind of hyperactive, or some people have high anxiety or hysteria, and they're getting, you know, really worked up, sometimes a cold face, a cold rag on the face is a way to relax them. So it's really quite interesting. But, you know, you think about these different aspects. And then we're just kind of pulling it together, the thermal zone. How is it that we regulate our body temperature? We know we have these thermal set points in our brain, right, in the hypothalamic region, but they control your body temperature. They're detecting the blood temperature that goes by. So these are ion channels that then respond to that temperature, and we've talked about that, like with the thermal probes that we did in the lab, remember? Or if you had a diet of capsaicin, right, hot pepper, it actually activates those too, or you put a hot pepper on your skin, you feel that burning. Those receptors are activated by that capsaicin. But the same thing, if you ate it, it makes you think you're hot, so you start to cool down, right? So it changes that thermal set point. The point is, if you're in the cold environment, you know what happens. You start to shiver, right? So if you're shivering, what do? You're raising your metabolic energy, you know, use, and you're producing heat from the breakdown of proteins, right? Or making ATP. That shivering raises your temperature, and then it raises your blood temperature and then back to your brain. Or if you're too hot, you need to kind of cool down, you might be panting or waving or sweating, but metabolic rate might go up to try to cool yourself down, but the net result is to try to cool the body. But if you go too far cold, right, you can't keep up with it and you die. And if you go too hot and you can't keep up cooling your body, you die, right? So it's kind of interesting. You got that thermal zone, but then you can regulate it for a certain level, but if it goes too long on either side for homeotherms, you know, death. Think about those little, what do they call those things? The sea monkeys again. What's a sea monkey called? Anybody remember what a sea monkey's called? I'm forgetting what the name. Oh, yeah, brain shrimp. Thank you. You know, that they can live, and you dry them out, and they can live for 100 years or 200 years, right? And you can rehydrate them, and they come back to life. Can you imagine? I mean, is that not amazing, right? And they can, if they're dehydrated, you can actually put them in the freezer and then warm them back up and put them back in water, and they come back to life. I mean, that's phenomenal, right? It's just so amazing that some animals can handle that kind of change. So you think about what people are interested in, right? Like space and maybe animal life coming to Earth in different ways. And you think about these animals that can handle that. That's kind of neat to think about. Okay. Brown fat, like a bat that might be hibernating. This is kind of interesting because we have brown fat too in us. And they found that even as adults, we might have a bit of brown fat, and that helps with thermal regulation. But primarily babies have it, infants have it, in the middle of their back, between their shoulder blades. And they might have that little fat bump between their shoulder blades. And that's kind of interesting. And it's just no different than the bat. The bat has this also, and they use it for thermal regulation. So this brown fat, the nervous system, can actually cause this to be active. And just because the metabolism in the brown fat, burning it up, raises the body temperature because the circulation goes through. And how does this work is really neat. It's like your skeletal muscle. It's really quite cool. It's just metabolism, and because you break proteins or you make ATP, what are you doing? All the metabolic energy, it's heat production as a end product, right? And it's not really for making ATP to use your muscles, but it's just to go through the enzymatic reactions for the net result of heat. Just like when you exercise, if you lifted your book 10 times and you felt your arm, it's going to be warmer than it was before you started that exercise. It's that heat production that you have. So it's pretty cool. And we talked about neurons and stuff and how animals can cool themselves just like us with vasodilation. But you think of a rabbit ear is very important for their temperature regulation, for example. All right? Pretty neat to think about. And we talked about set points already and shivering. And, you know, shivering raises your body temperature, as you know. But some animals have some really neat aspects, and this is a kind of an interesting one. It was kind of mystifying for a long time, and some people realized that these animals specifically would have more blood flow to these regions, like on a hot day, for example. So you think about what's going on here is you have blood coming by, and if the air breathing in and out can actually go past this capillary bed, you could cool it down and actually change the blood temperature by having this little reef, a capillary bed, which increases the surface area. It's really no different than, you know, like having a good surface area to cool off, like evaporative cooling, but think of it by the air going by the tissue that has an increase in surface area. You could cool it down, for example, on a hot day by respiration and cooling down. So they call this a RET, R-E-T-E, and they see this in animals that, and utilized, and it's like a hot day, for example, that they'll increase their breathing, and they can watch the blood flow go to this region, and to keep what? Keep the brain not to overheat. So you can actually get the brain to be at a temperature that would be suitable to keep the brain alive. Okay. And the last kind of part is on hibernation, just that we think about, and a general concept, do bears hibernate? Do bears hibernate? You hear about it all the time, right? Bears hibernating. But does a bear truly hibernate? What's true hibernation? True hibernation is when the body temperature drops, like for a long period of time, right? And the metabolism drops for a long period of time. And then it might warm up and, you know, come back in the spring. So the idea that bears hibernate, really they haven't shown them to keep their body temperature down for a long period of time. So they're not true hibernators. But what are some of the true hibernators are like squirrels. They've measured some of these squirrels that can hibernate where their body temperature drops and it stays down for the whole winter until they're ready to come back out of hibernation and it warms up. So let's think about it. Why would a bear maybe not be a true hibernator where a squirrel would be a true hibernator? Why do you think there might be a difference? Why bears might not be true hibernators to keep their body temperature low for a long period of time? Concepts. Isn't that interesting? Lots of neat things out there. Think of the mass of the animal, right? That mass, it's going to take a long time to warm it back up. In the springtime, it's going to have to... How is it going to warm its body back up? It's going to take a long time, right? And if it wanted to be ready for, you know, a predator or something, or be able to capture something, or be ready to, I don't know, respond to a human going in the cave, right? It's going to take a longer time to heat that body back up. So people have thought about this and look at true hibernators or smaller mammals, for example. And they can raise their body temperature faster, being a small animal, than you could a larger animal. So a bear might drop the temperature down a bit, but then it's going to go back up. It's going to go down. It's going to go back up. It doesn't stay down for a long period of time. Just the opposite of hibernation is a term called estivation. But it's the same kind of idea. And people have studied this in the Middle East quite a bit with rodents and squirrels, like squirrel animals. And what they've actually shown is that on a very hot summer, when it's so hot outside, they'll go in their burrow and actually do something like hibernation. Decrease their metabolism, decrease their temperature, and kind of go into a state of dormancy. So hibernation's associated with cold temperature, but estivation is with warmer temperature. But it's the same idea. Decrease metabolism, get through that environment so you can survive. But pretty neat. Okay, and we've talked about pyrogenic, you know, like bacteria. I think it was day one in the class, right? If you inject a bacteria, your body temperature goes up and you wonder, why do you have a fever? What's the benefits of fever? Still questionable about why you have a fever. And is it, would it be better to bring it down, the fever, or is it better to let the fever go? It's a natural process, right? So why are we fighting this natural process? By dropping the fever? You know, this is a question that you could have too. Your body's pretty well, you know, physiological abilities to handle survival. So why are we fighting it? Why don't we go along with it? Kind of interesting thought process, right? So some of these ideas are out there. But you can inject pyrogens even into invertebrates, and you can see behavioral changes that they try to keep their body temperature at a certain level. And other animals, even reptiles, have a response to bacterial infections. But the body temperature will go up, and they might even then try a behavioral change to warm their body up, like sit in the sun. Isn't that, it's wild, right? So really interesting in how that works on the set point. But just to kind of think about gee-whizzy fun stuff, in a sense. But then if you get the mechanisms, and you think of survival of the species, it becomes more philosophical in trying to understand those processes. Oxygen deprivation, we're pretty pathetic with that, right? We found out if you hold your breath, what happens? You really want to, you know, like 2 minutes, and your PO2, did that change? No. But probably the CO2 and your pH drop, and that drove you to breathe, right? But some animals can handle low oxygen really well, and so why can't we handle that better? And it's kind of interesting aspects. So some animals can really handle it for a long period of time with low oxygen and survive. And it's amazing what can happen. Okay, so we've pretty much covered everything in the textbook, and we got through it all. I wanted to show you this kind of neat little simulator. Some people had questions about Goldman-Hodgkin cats and Nernst equation. But you can Google Nernst-Goldman simulator, for example, and you come up with this really cool simulator that is online, free, and it's really neat. So if you're having some questions, like even in your lab, what did you do in your lab? You raised external potassium. So here's the resting membrane potential. Let's raise external potassium. You see that the equilibrium potential for potassium raised right there. So if you had it down here, you know, then if you opened up a chloride, a potassium channel, where's the resting? Let's raise this up a little bit. Put it right there. If you did something, like let's run a simulator here. Let's change the Let's do a Nernst equation. Let's do a Nernst. If you then change this and you raised, let's see, it's supposed to function. There we go. Simulator. If you raise the external sodium, you can see what would happen there. If we raise internal sodium, you know, what happens to the resting membrane potential, for example. But if you put it in the Golden-Hodgkin-Katz equation, you change permeability of sodium, you see it depolarizes. If you change the external potassium, for example, the membrane potential follows that equilibrium potential for potassium. So people wrote these little programs based on the Golden-Hodgkin-Katz equation, like for a squid, for example, at different temperatures, and it's really quite neat because you can understand those properties. So if you're still having problems on some issues on the Nernst equation, the Golden-Hodgkin-Katz equation, kind of go through this downloadable simulator, and it helps you even with that lab. I probably should have brought that up when we did that lab. That would have been maybe better for visualization. All right? So that's kind of neat. So let's think about some other things. Just to remind you, on Wednesday, which is tomorrow, right? Showcase of Scholars. Some of you might be presenting there, right? But it's over there at the new Student Center, 3 to 6. They should have free food, so if you want to go by and get a snack, you can go by and get a snack. Always look for snacks. But students all across campus are presenting their research, from music, engineering, chemistry, to biology, or people working over at the med school. So something fun to go do tomorrow, 3 to 6. So let's think about review. What did we cover this semester? What did we cover? Whew. Physiology, right? A lot of physiology. Questions on old exams. If you have a question, somebody else probably has the same question. Questions. Anybody have a question? Have people looked at the old exams yet? Hopefully you've gone through the test banks, right? And looked at it, because there's only so many ways you can ask about the action potential amplitude, or the downstroke of the action potential, or the upstroke, or what is threshold, what is absolute refractory period, what is relative refractory period, what promotes glomerular filtration, what is glomerular filtration, do you remember how to measure clearance, which is the same as glomerular filtration, how do you measure clearance, what's an equation you can remember, C equals, what does the sun do to you, it causes skin cancer, right? By the UV. UV, how do you block that? How do you decrease the cancer? Use protection, right? So divide by P. So concentration of the urine flow rate divided by the concentration of the plasma of a substance, then you can measure clearance, right? Or just ways to remember this. Corny ways. I remember. It's corny. All right. Some other things that we have to know about. Some people have math phobia. So that's an equation. What's another good equation that we should know? We just went over it, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, and people always make the mistake about the permeability of potassium times the concentration of potassium outside over the permeability times concentration of potassium, say, on the inside. And then they put a big plus sign, and then they do the next one, but it's not. It's right. It's a whole line across there, right? So don't make that mistake, because you might find, if you do make that mistake, that answer might be there too, right? Because to kind of get you going, that, oh, I got the right answer, but it was the wrong equation. So, work it out, kind of. So that's another equation. What's another equation we covered? Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz, Nernst equation, glomerular filtration. Boom, 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 boom. Anybody? Yeah? Charades. Cardiac output, right? Cardiac output. What's the equation for cardiac output? Heart rate times diastolic pressure. Heart rate times systolic pressure. Heart rate times stroke volume. Yay. Okay. So, think about those things, because all those other kind of equations might be on there. Or you might get, as you're finding out, superfluous information in the question, right, that you don't need. So this is real life, right? In real life, you get a lot of superfluous information that you only want to go to the main points for that equation. What was another equation we covered? A wonderful one. You have a tattoo for, maybe, besides C6H12O6 plus 6 oxygens. Ohm's Law. Do you remember Ohm's Law? Ohm's Law. Does that ring a bell? Oh my gosh, I forgot. I equals B over R. Current equals B over R. Or I, R equals B. It goes back to when we were talking about membrane potentials and stuff like that. What is R in this case? Membrane resistance, if you're looking at the effects of a cell. I think those are pretty much the equations we covered, right? So not too many. Not so bad, right? Not so bad. No, we don't get a cheat sheet. Somebody emailed me about that. Do we get a sheet to take a cheat sheet in for the final? No. And you have to cover up your tattoos, okay? So that won't work. What are some other things that we covered? So if you have your textbook, if you have a textbook, or you have your PowerPoints, I would flip through your textbook if you're using that one that we generally suggested, or the other one, you know, like the Animal Phys one by Eckert. It's a little bit old, mine's coming apart. But it has some really just the general points. And remember, this is a survey course. I understand there's a lot of content. You know, you could have a course just on renal, a course just on heart, a course just on nervous system, or whatever. So it is a lot of information. I understand. It's as bad as 152. 152 is even worse, right? Because it's just so much stuff. But generally, you could flip through your textbook or you could flip through the PowerPoints and you could kind of say, like, you know, chapter one, what was the main points that we covered? You know, negative feedback was the main point in that one, right? And primary structure, secondary structure, tertiary structure, quaternary structure, remember all that good stuff? Chapter two, that we in this textbook, what was the main point? Anybody remember? One take home. Desert kangaroo rat should come to your mind. What does that represent? That's right. August Croak principle. Love that love that part. Who knows if that's on the final or not. I'm not sure. Maybe. And then we talked about membrane fluidity, right? And the bilipids. Saturated versus unsaturated. Cholesterol. Length, carbon chain length, right? Carbon chain length. And does that increase or decrease membrane fluidity? So you know, think about these main processes. pH. Does pH change with temperature? Don't know. Forgot. pH equals the negative log of the hydrogen ion concentration. Where's temperature? That's because they taught you wrong all these years, right? So there is a temperature factor in there. It's times the activity coefficient. Higher temperature, lower pH, right? Because water disassociates, you get more hydrogen ions. That's what you're measuring as a pH, right? So then you think about animals have to condition themselves for temperature changes with pH buffering as well. Okay, then we got through chapter three, the horrible part of glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain. And everybody just like, oh, I've had that like 10 times now, purge it. Right, but you know, the main points that we've covered, right, just the main kind of aspects. Where does glycolysis take place? In the mitochondria, right? No, in the cytosol, right? Don't be tricked. Keep in mind. And on that last test, on the scantrons, I see people erasing, and actually you changed your answer from a right answer to a wrong answer. Be very careful when you change your answers because a lot of people have changed their answers to the wrong answer and they had the original right answer. The questions are not meant to be tricky. 75 questions would make 150 points, right, for the final because it is 150 points. I know it's a lot of points. But some of those questions you should recognize, hint, and some of those straight out of the test bank, probably most all, and then what did we have? We just didn't have 75 questions. We put 78 questions. So if you freak out with a question, don't worry about it. You got 78. So you can make more than 100% on this test. I want to see more than 100% on this test, right? So you should be able to make like 103%, really, right? So if you freak out with one question, just don't worry about it. You got 78. They're all multiple choice, multiple guess. And if you're worried about how long it takes, just go C's all the way down. And you'll be done in 10 minutes, and you can go out and, you know, go sit in the sun. But the grade won't be what good, right? So it will take some time. You've got 78 questions, multiple choice. You don't have to drag it out, but I would go through and, like, check the main ones that you think are right. The problem is you read through it, and you think, oh, that's the right answer, A, right? Because that's the first one. But actually, it might be C, right? So kind of read through all the ones and eliminate, process of elimination. If you don't know the question, at least you could probably just guess pretty well by knocking down four of the ones and get down to, you know, something in there and maybe guess, you know, between A and B or something. But go through all the answers and do the process of elimination. That's the best way for this. You should be finished in an hour or so. I don't think it's going to take more than an hour, really, to do this. So if you're planning to skedat out of town. But it's a Monday, right? Isn't it a Monday? Or is it a Tuesday? It's a Tuesday, like 8 o'clock, right? Horrible time. So what do you want to do in the morning? You don't want to just get up and come here because the cortisol levels can only do so much to raise your glucose. And glucose is really good. So orange juice in the morning, glucose, bring a candy bar, sugar, just a sugar, candy. I'll try to get some candies for you. Sugar is really good. That does do a quick surge of glucose in your brain. I mean, that's well known, right? So that glucose, but your brain doesn't store glucose, right? Your brain just kind of uses the glucose that's in your blood, and then it drops very quickly. It doesn't store that glucose very well. All right, so you definitely want some glucose. So if we keep going through this, we know about enzymes and what enzymes do. They lower the activation energy, right? And we know about proteins working and enzymes working in certain temperatures, salt environment, pH environment, like in your GI tract that we talked about. All right. We didn't get too crazy with some of the enzyme functions. Glycolysis, you should know all that stuff. Chapter 4, you know, ion balance, sodium higher on the inside or outside of most cells, potassium higher on the outside or inside of most cells, right? And we kind of talked about invertebrates, seawater invertebrates with renal versus freshwater invertebrates. And what happens if you put a red blood cell into a, you know, freshwater or seawater? I know that's gee whizzy, but you know that's how animals regulate their osmoregulation with their environment as well, like seawater animals or freshwater animals. Proteins and transport across cells, is it linear process or is it a saturatable process? If it's saturatable, then it's a carrier-mediated process or an ion channel, right? So those kind of things, think about. We talked about, you know, co-transport, anti-transport, antiporters, symbiporters, pumps. Okay, and this is a good example, but we came back to this in the renal system or in the GI system about co-transport amino acids along with sodium. So if in your GI tract, if you maybe had amino acids, they're not going to get across. Or sugar, it's not going to get across unless maybe you had some salt in there too, right? Because it's a co-transporter, sodium and glucose. So, you know, co-transport is very important. We talked about cholera, for example, the first method to treat cholera so you can save dehydration. Number one killer worldwide of potential life, right? Very simple treatment to start off with. Ion channels and how they can be collected. We talked about that before. Remember all that horrible stuff we went over in the first test? Some people forgot about channels and how they might selectively have one ion to come through, either a negative one or a positive ion, or size, right? Or the charge of the channel, the charge of the ion. And what was the other aspect? The hydration sphere, right? Pulling the waters off, right? Important too. So how big that hydration sphere is. Okay, gap junctions, chemical transmission, a lot. Again, that sodium potassium pump. Anything that you take away is from the classes that probably the highest energy demanding process in your body is really maintaining that sodium potassium pump for so many reasons, right? Like we emphasized over and over again. Nobel Prize was given to that. A lot of that work was actually described in the crab muscle. Isn't that amazing? See those invertebrates? Don't we just wish to be reincarnated as an invertebrate? Great. Might end up in a lab. All right. Then we get through the nervous system and synaptic transmission and all that good stuff, you know, resting membrane potential and what regulates the resting membrane potential, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, the permeability of channels, right? Remember, leak channels are different than voltage-gated channels, right? And thresholds of ion channels. Do know the shape of the action potential. Oh, my gosh, you know, back from 152, you had it again, probably in cell, and you can have it again. You go, if you're into med school, for example, you're going to get that again, and it's going to be the shape of the action potential again. You're going, oh, my God, how do I keep remembering? And if you're over here across the street, Dexter Speck teaches that sometimes in physiology, and he says to the med school class, it's really hilarious, he says, remember, we are not crayfish, if you had Cooper's animal physiology class. We are mammals, and some things are different. So it's kind of funny, but anyways, he gets angry about some things. Like we don't have inhibitory motor nerves. Remember that, right? And so somebody wrote that on one of their med school exams that they had an open thing. Oh, GABA is the inhibitory transmitter. It's neuromuscular junctions. Oh, my God. Just messed them all up. So, yes, comparative phys is different than animal phys. I mean, human phys, all right? So do think about that. All right. So Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, driving gradients, all that good stuff. All right. Action potential. Absolute refractor period, relative refractor period. What's the main take home with that?
sodium channel inactivation, right? And getting them to start reactivating. The only way you get those to come back is to come back to a resting membrane potential for a given amount of time to take away the inactivation, right? See, that's a good. So that was, you know, the first test, ion channels, all that good stuff. Then we talked about, you know, the properties of electrical conduction, right? We've talked about length constant. What is the length constant? Lambda. What's the main take-home of that? At some length, some distance, where the amplitude of the potential drops 63%, 37% remaining, right? And then you think of time constant, that's different. That's the time it takes to drop 63% or 37% remaining. That's the decay. But you could also turn it around and look at the rise constant, the rise tau constant, the time it takes to get a change of 63% or only 37% remaining to the peak amplitude, right? Whatever it is. But don't get confused, because 67 or 30, whatever it was, now I can't remember, the change, but 16, you know, the tau, around there, right? So, very close. Woo! Okay, I'm getting there. 63%, that's it, okay. And 37% remaining, all right. Plaques building up. Don't have enough glial lymph. I'm not sleeping enough. All right, so, conduction velocity, covered that before, right? And your compound foot nerve that you've covered in the lab. Kind of look over the main points of the lab. And conduction velocity, you saw that on old quizzes or exams, right? And here too, axon diameter, less axial resistance. Think of fire hose, garden hose, right? We talked about that. Those kind of ideas. Synaptic transmission, we really covered it well, of nerve terminal, voltage change, open up voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium comes in, causes the vesicle to fuse. Magic occurs, right? You know, the vesicle fuses, releases the content. Vesicle turns around, recycles, repackages. But like at the neuromuscular junction in us, acetylcholine is released, binds to the nicotinic receptors. What does that do? Causes a graded depolarization. It might reach threshold and fire an action potential down the plasma membrane, down the T-tubules. What does it hit? Dihydropyridine receptors, which are voltage-gated proteins, which then pulls the plug out of the from the ranitidine receptor that's in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Calcium dumps in. What does it do? It binds to troponin C, causes a conformational change, exposes the active site. Myosin heads are waiting, binds to it, contracts. ATP hydrolysis, heads come back. They'll keep rebinding if the active site's exposed, but if the active site's not exposed, because the pump, the circa, is pumping calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the calcium drops, troponin C doesn't have the calcium anymore, conformational change, hide the active site, the myosin heads try to bind, they can't, so muscle can relax, right? So the whole idea, go through all that, right? Keep it just that you could just, you know it right down, like your name. Okay, so that's good to think about, synaptic transition. It's really important. Bernard Katz, right? We don't have to remember these names, right? But Bernard Katz, fantastico. He's one of those, put your hands together and hum. It's like a god. All right. So, in quantal analysis, we talked about quantal transmission, single vesicle, right? Single vesicle. Oh, all that. See? That's not so bad. Short-term facilitation, you know, calcium builds up in the presynaptic nerve terminal. Next action potential comes around before the calcium can come down. Builds in that residual calcium. You're going to get a bigger evoked response, right? Hopefully, this is ringing bells. We talked about, you know, proteins can go up and down in the membrane, right? Like LTP, they know that glutamate receptors can be put into the membrane so you can get an increased response. Or proteins can come out of the membrane and then you don't have as much response, so it's called long-term depression. So it's a postsynaptic phenomenon. But we just talked about a presynaptic phenomenon. You know, calcium changing can increase transmission as well. Really neat. That was a big debate for like 10 years. Sensing chapter, which we didn't ask a lot of questions on, but there's a lot of information in that too. But the main take-homes are not that big of a thing, right? That in the word adaptation in the textbooks is used a bit weird here, right, for sensory adaptation. And the MRO, the muscle receptor organ, or the Purkinje corpuscles are good examples of that. Right, that it might not still keep firing when you have the stimulus still on it. Remember the onion layer? That's a standardized exam kind of question, a percentage corpuscle. Take like a pencil, shove it into the middle of the onion, and you push on it. The end of the pencil might feel that pressure, right? But if the onion layers can move, you no longer have that pressure on the sensory ending, and so it doesn't fire anymore. Remove the pushing on the onion layers, and then it might respond because it stretches on it until the onion layers can reform again around that. So the idea of adaptation in sensory systems versus tonic. What is the main aspect? How do you mechanically stimulate that sensory neuron? Stretch-activated ion channels, right? Stretch-activated ion channels. The same like with your thermal, some of your other aspects in your brain. So percipient corpuscle, we covered that. We didn't get too heavy in lots of other aspects in there, but we did talk about like the inner ear and the semicircular canals for equilibrium. Statocysts are the in a lobster, for example, the stones that sit on the little membrane statocysts, so it can sense gravity. We also have something very similar like that, the utriculus and sacculus that are inside our inner ear, little stones that sit on a membranous tissue that has these hair cells that bend one direction or the other direction, tells you if your head's moving one way or static position one way or the other way. So when you pass out during the exam, you know, your head's turned to the side. And then the snail-like structure is the hearing structure, right? So that's the cochlea for hearing. We talked about that. We talked about statocyst and a lobster. General points. Hopefully this is all recorded. Rods and cones. What do? Which one's for color vision? Cones. C for cones. C for color. Color. Rods. Dark. Light. Dark. And do you have? Are they active in the dark? Or are they only active in the light? Rods and cones. Active in the dark, right? So they call it a dark current because it's a sodium current. Light actually stops the transmission. So it's kind of interesting. But ommatidia, insect eye. What happens there with light? Does it hyperpolarize or depolarize? Depolarize in the insect eye, right? But in the vertebrate eye, the rods and cones with light, it hyperpolarizes. Odd, right? So you got a stimulus, it should depolarize. But no, the rods and cones, it hyperpolarizes. It decreases activity. So kind of remember that stuff. Okay. We didn't do too much. And then it comes to endocrine. Oh my gosh. Endocrine. Right? Horrible stuff. So much to remember. But we covered the main points. Don't get buried and get lost in the forest here. Those main hormones that we talked about, we should know where they come from. Hypothalamus, anterior pituitary, posterior pituitary, right? Thyroid gland, all that stuff. On your old exams, for example, the main points there. I'm not asking about some little hormone that we didn't really cover, like VIP or something in the GI tract. It's the main points here. You can take an endocrinology course if you want to. It's really good, vertebrate endocrinology. But the main points. All right. Oxytocin, vasopressin, LH, FSH. What do they do in the female? What do they do in the male, right? In the menstrual cycle for the female, we covered that. Should know luteal phase, follicular phase, what goes on, which hormones are the highest at those different phases. What does the follicle generally secrete? What hormone? Progesterone or estrogen? Estrogen. The corpus luteum? Estrogen or progesterone? Normally, progesterone. But if fertilization takes place in chorionic gonadotropin, stimulates the corpus luteum to maintain pregnancy, both estrogen and progesterone are produced, right? Generally, that's the general takeaway. Okay, so, you know, and then we talk about calcium regulation a little bit. Calcitonin, tone for the bone, right? Versus parathyroid hormone. Oh my gosh. People, remember that quiz, that test that we took, and people had a hard time with this. But actually, if you just look at that and draw three sarcomeres, not so bad, right? And you know the A band, I band, H band, right? So kind of remember the general structure of a sarcomere. People lost a lot of points on that, but I don't know why. Okay, and then, you know, muscle contraction, calcium, we just talked about that. Fast muscle, slow muscle, oxidative or glycolytic, right? Red or white, kind of know the differences there. All right, and then we're right back to where we were not that long ago was circulation. Right? That's not that long ago. The heart, we should know the chambers and how that works generally. And then we got into renal. And then renal, GI. And then GI, kind of body temperature and regulation. So if you look back, it does seem like a tremendous amount, but it's not so bad. You know, the main points. But you do have to refresh your memory, right, on these things. So if you have questions on old exams, if you haven't had time to study, you slept all weekend or something, which is good, get ready for it. But if you have some questions, maybe even take a picture of your phone, with your phone of an old test or something, and you say, I think it's B because of this, then I'll respond back. But if you say, what are the answers for these questions? And I'll probably say, you know, wait until you figure out something and tell me the best answer you have and why. Okay? But I'm glad to help out. Even if you want to do a voice recording, those are really good too. Just say, I'm confused with LH. What does LH do in a male, for example? I think it does this, but I'm not sure. Then I'll answer back with a voicemail too. Voicemails are really easy to do. Just recording your phone if you're not driving or something, right? And then back and forth. But I'll try to answer as quick as I can. Are we good? Do we need class on Thursday? If not, I'll let you all go if you want, or we can come. Or if you want to go over questions. But if you want to email, we can email and do that way as well. So I'll send out an email today unless there's a desire. How many want to meet on Thursday morning? Everybody's hands up. Oh, my goodness. No, I'm joking. So what we'll do is I'll send out it on Canvas that we don't have to have class on Thursday. And that if you have questions, email, all right? And then I'll try to respond back. Even over the weekend, I'm a little busy on the weekend because we have some Junior Kentucky Academy of Science stuff to do in Frankfurt. And then some more stuff on Sunday with high school kids and their science projects that are going to International Science Fair. But then I will try to respond back in the evenings as best I can. I got 2 full 8-hour days with high school kids. All right. So go for it. Good luck with all your finals, all right? It's been a great semester.
One quick question.
Yeah.